You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our second of four podcasts on integrating disease-modifying therapies in the management of Alzheimer's, hosted by Med Learning Group. Our overarching goal is to support primary care physicians, neurologists, psychiatrists, geriatricians, and other multidisciplinary team members who manage patients with Alzheimer's disease. This podcast series will focus on timely screening and the diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease and the integration of disease-modifying treatments in clinical practice. My name is Surabhi Dangi Garimala, and I'll be your host for today's podcast. In our first episode, we heard about the important role played by primary care in MCI management. In this episode, we will explore the tools used by neurologists to screen and diagnose MCI due to AD and the pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic treatments, including DMTs, used in care management. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce and welcome our program chair, Dr. George Grossberg, and our guest expert, Dr. Marwan Sabbagh.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Marwan. Nice to have you.
Thank you, George. Good to see you.
So we're going to start off, Marwan, with a case from my clinic. Okay, I'm sure it's someone that's similar to patients that you see, but it's Mr. McMillan, who is a 72-year-old high school principal, still working as a high school principal, came to our clinic accompanied by his wife and adult daughter. The family had noticed changes in recent memory over the past 6 to 12 months, such as misplacing things, which caused a lot of frustration for the patient. They were also concerned that he was having more difficulties making decisions, kind of complicated things, like where to invest their money, more difficulties kind of managing the checkbook than previously. More recently, they got concerned as well because his wife asked him to go to the supermarket to pick up a few items. He went to the supermarket, came back, and had forgotten a number of the items that she had asked him to purchase. And then the daughter also noted that, you know, they have, I think, six grandchildren, that sometimes when the whole family's together, you might mix up the name of one versus the other. And these were things that he didn't do previously. On the other hand, very important, there were no reports of any problems at his employment, at his job. And he was independent in all of his basic activities of daily living, like dressing, bathing, grooming, and so on. There was a family history in that his father was diagnosed with what used to be called senile dementia when he was in his mid-70s. Medical history, you know, pretty typical, well-managed, well-controlled hypertension, hyperlipidemia, osteoarthritis, reflux disease, allergic rhinitis. Medications, again, were, you know, very typical. Blood pressure med being lisinopril hydrochlorothiazide. He's on a statin for lipids. He takes acetaminophen for pain, famotidine for reflux, cetirizine for his allergies, and he's on a couple of vitamins, vitamin D3 and a B-complex multivitamin. No history of alcohol or substance use. On mental status, he looked pretty good. He's alert. His speech was goal-directed. He did look to his wife at times for confirmation of certain answers about questions that we asked him, but he was not depressed, not anxious, not psychotic. Vital signs, physical exam, all stable, unremarkable. No focal neurologic findings, although he didn't do very well on a smell test. On screening tests, we administer the St. Louis University Mental Status, which is very similar to others like the MoCA and the MMSE. He scored a 25 out of 30. His PHQ-9 was a 2. And according to his family, who filled out the Barthel ADL inventory, he was 100% independent in the ADLs. We did some routine blood work, a couple of specialized blood tests, CMP, CBC, TSH, B12 folate, homocysteine, CRP. They're all within normal limits. His brain imaging, the MRI, showed basically small vessel disease subcortically. So I'm sure that you see people like Mr. McMillan. So I'm just wondering, you know, what you would be thinking diagnostically as far as possible next steps and therapeutic options, both as far as kinds of things you would advise lifestyle-wise for his family, to his family, for him, as well as any medication interventions.
Yeah, so very typical case, George. We have probably the same patients in our clinics every day. The first thing I'm going to say is when I looked through the case history, the head turning sign is a tip off. I thought that was a pretty typical. That has a leans toward an Alzheimer process. The profile and the I would assume on the slums, the free any recall task would be normal or would be impaired or amnestic. So the reason I say this too is that, you know, it's B12, TSH, and MRI. Normal means effectively that you've excluded other pathology, but we're moving to the time, you and I, where, and our colleagues now should be looking for a biomarker diagnosis. So I would say clinical phenotype is mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease. And in my practice, I'm already starting to use the blood-based biomarkers as screening tools. I might, if they're abnormal, I might go on to secondary testing at CSF or PET, and then I might even genotype them based on the family history and the hyperlipidemia. So there's a lot of ways you could go about this, because the fundamental issue is that the phenotype of mild cognitive impairment does not give you that's a categorical definition. It's not an etiological definition. You've already excluded stroke, tumor, hydrocephalus, Parkinson's, and Lewy body based on your history. So those are all off the list. So you're really starting to think about whether this is an Alzheimer process, given the clinical presentation, but you need a biomarker confirmation to look at the etiological approach.
Yeah. Just interestingly, Marwan, I did a segment with a primary care physician, and he had asked about blood-based biomarkers, but they're basically not very knowledgeable about their use, and they're not yet incorporating them into their day-to-day practice. And you're saying that you do use them regularly, and which one or ones in particular do you utilize, and how do they pay for it, the patients?
So but George, remember, I am subspecialty, just like you, super specialists. And so I'm not in the primary care. I'm not in the front lines of these patients. Every time a blood-based biomarker comes out, I don't just get the test. I ask the company what ICD-10 codes are. And I use this, what I call the spaghetti method. I use every code that's allowed, and I add them all when I have the diagnosis. And I know that my clinic manager has not come to me and said, stop ordering that test. Because usually when that happens, that means patients are complaining that they're getting these bills. So far, the spaghetti method seems to be working. I order p-tau217, 181 A-beta 42 to 40 ratio, and neurofilament light. And it's about a year and a half I'm in here now. But again, I'm a specialist. This might be reflective of the fact that I'm a specialist and I just have accessibility that other people don't have.
Yeah, no, I understand that. So related to cases like this, which you see and I see all the time in our clinics, do you think that neurologists in general and all of us are seeing more, not just Alzheimer's, but early MCI patients, or are we not there yet? Do we need to educate more?
No, I think we are. And it's a particular, this audience, of course, being both psychiatrist, neurologist, and primary care, these patients are walking into primary care first. They're not just walking into our specialty clinics. They're actually starting at the primary care. And the minimum thing we want our primary care colleagues to do is take a complaint seriously. Do not delay. Do not, just don't dismiss it. Evaluate it at a minimum or refer on. Be aware of the biomarkers, even if you're not ordering them. Be aware of the transformation of Alzheimer's diagnosis from a diagnosis of exclusion, which has only in primary care a 66% accuracy rate, to a diagnosis of inclusion, which now has a diagnostic accuracy in the 90 to 95, 96% range. And so we are now in a transformative moment in our field, about years in my field, to be able to diagnose patients accurately. And if they get nothing else, they should be aware of this from this podcast.
Yeah, I think those are great points. So if we're going to be getting hopefully better and better at diagnosing patients earlier, getting them in the MCI stage or very early dementia stage with Alzheimer's disease, can you give the clinicians that are listening to us any guidelines for more accurate diagnosis of MCI due to AD or very early dementia with AD?
Yes, I do. That's the critical question, George. So we know, for example, that the diagnosis of exclusion that we have been doing and just the phenotypic approach is not very accurate. And it doesn't give you the etiological diagnosis. So the etiological diagnosis, if we're going to get to Alzheimer's with the possibility of increasing our diagnostic accuracy and the possibility of a monoclonal antibody, we need to use the diagnostics. Even if you're a little bit don't have availability or reticent to use the blood-based biomarkers, you really need to be on board potentially with the amyloid PET or CSF testing. I hear this argument that CSF testing is a little bit invasive. Why would I do that to my patients? That seems a little bit unnecessary. And I say to you that if the patient had meningitis, you're doing lumbar puncture. If they have encephalitis, they're doing lumbar puncture. If they're doing a multiple sclerosis workup evaluation, you're doing lumbar puncture. So it is very arbitrary to not do it for Alzheimer's. So CSF testing is available, approved, reimbursed. PET is available, approved, reimbursed. So we need to get on board with the idea of using the biomarkers that are available in our toolbox. And if there's also kind of, if there's a mixed pathology, as you know, a lot of these patients are mixed, depression, meds, alcohol, et cetera, then I order neuropsych testing on top of that.
Yeah, I think you and I do the similar kinds of things. But when I talk with a very prominent primary care physician, he mentioned to me that in the typical busy primary care practice, they either don't have the expertise or the time or both to make a good differential diagnosis. They may not have availability of amyloid PET or spinal fluid testing. So they often will refer to a specialist, and he mentioned specifically referring to neurology. I had mentioned to him that in my area, it takes up to 6 months to get a new patient into a neurologist. He said in his area, it was only 3 months. So how are the neurologists, not just you, but in general in the community, dealing with all of these referrals? And what does the future hold?
Yeah, I feel like if we can move the needle on neurology, it would be huge. Some markets are taking up to a year to get in to see a specialist from primary care. There's always the discussion as to where the blood-based biomarkers should land. And I'm of the opinion that they would be very useful in primary care, like a PSA or a hemoglobin A1C. I think that would be good. That's a couple of years before it gets adopted, as you know. But the access to primary specialty care is limited. The interest or knowledge of use of these tests is limited. And yet we can diagnose patients with accuracy. It's funny because I get all these primary care residents in my clinics, and you know, they still are taught, George, that you can only diagnose Alzheimer's disease with an autopsy. So we got to start at the residency or the medical school level. We got to educate correctly. We got to train, put this into their training programs.
Yeah. So those are excellent comments. Related to that, one of the issues that I've come up with in our area is that there are very few general neurologists. Now, you're a cognitive neurologist.
Yeah, I am. You know, you and I are unicorns, right? There's a handful of us, right? There's not that many of us.
But if you think about general neurologists, there aren't enough of those because, again, more and more are specializing. So some of my colleagues do stroke neurology, or they do movement disorders, or they do epilepsy, or they do, you know, neuromuscular. They don't want to deal with dementia patient. It's the general neurologist who see them, and they see everything else, all kinds of other things too. So how do we address this issue?
It's a trick. So, you know, you're at St. Louis University, large neurology and psychiatry department, Barrow Neurological Institute. We have 63 neurologists. Only in the memory division, there's two neuropsychiatrists and 1.5 neurologists, and I am the one. So they're just accessibility is a big problem. Most other specialties of neurology just do not want to deal with it. This is our day job, George. This is yours and my day job. We do this all the time. But even outside of our specialty, there's a reticence to learn about it, to know about it. And so their default is just refer out and get to the specialist. But that just adds to our backlog.
Yeah. So we're going to get to the role of the disease-modifying therapies. But before we do that, maybe talk a bit about, let's say, your role or the neurologist's role relative to being a member of the team, relative to care coordination with primary care. You mentioned neuropsychology and so on. Where do you see that?
I think that the every group person in that care team is important. The neuropsychologist can help me to determine how much of the cognitive issues is related to a potential degenerative process versus something else like a mood disorder, a substance abuse disorder, et cetera. So that's important. The primary care is, you know, I'll take care of their Alzheimer's disease, but everything else, as you said, we talk about Mr. McMillan, right? Hyperlipidemia, hypertension, gastroesophageal reflux disease, osteoarthritis, everything else still has to be taken care of whether they have an Alzheimer's process or not. So the primary care can go back and forth on I'm managing the cognitive, the neurodegenerative disease, but they still have to take care of everything else. So it is a care team, and we building the care team, of course, includes our social workers. We have social workers. We have specialty nurses. We now have an infusion coordinator for the MABs. There's a lot of teams, and the team keeps growing, but it's not just one person at one point. It involves a care team.
So you mentioned the monoclonals, and you have an infusion director. That's quite a luxury. We usually use our fellows for some of that, but that's besides the point. But let's talk a bit about where you see the disease-modifying therapies as far as efficacy and monitoring and AE management, adverse effect management.
When you talk about lecanemab and donanemab, we're 2+ years into this journey. I myself have had well over 50, 60 patients getting the monoclonal antibody, so I have a lot of experience with this. We built our workflow. We have dot phrases. We have checklists. Like I said, to get a patient into an infusion care, the first thing you got to do is confirm the diagnosis. So they have to be mild cognitive impairment or mild dementia. So they have to have a SLUMS that's high, a MoCA that's above 20, the FAST, or whatever staging still has to be mild. The second thing is you have to confirm that they have amyloid, whether it's CSF or PET. The third thing you have to do is an MRI to make sure that they don't have a lot of microhemorrhages. So if their brain is riddled with microhemorrhages, you should not be giving them a monoclonal. And the fourth thing you do is APOE genotype them. I'm a little scared to give the APOE4 homozygotes a monoclonal antibody, but I heterozygous and non-carriers, I feel pretty comfortable with. Then if I have those patients, so let's say, I do this all the time. So let's say I've done all these checklists. I've confirmed they have mild cognitive impairment. I've confirmed they have amyloid. They're a 3-3 or 3-4 on the APOE. They have no microhemorrhages or 1 or 2 microhemorrhages on their MRI. Then I sit down with them and say, here are your 3 options for clinic, for treatment. I said, 1 is symptomatic treatment. So symptomatic treatment is donepezil, rivastigmine, galantamine, memantine. And I tell them that these are to Alzheimer's what acetaminophen is to arthritis. So if you take acetaminophen for arthritis, it takes away your knee pain, back pain, whatever, but doesn't take away the arthritis. I said, donepezil, rivastigmine, galantamine, memantine improve the symptoms of memory loss, but don't fundamentally alter the disease. Then I talk about monoclonal antibodies, lecanemab, donanemab. I talk about the fact that they do not make you better. They make you less worse. And I say it just like that. They make you less worse. And then I talk about the risks and the benefits and what are you buying and what you're not getting. And then I talk about the third option for us, at least in our center, is clinical trials. So I always give patients the 3 options. And we use shared decision-making. And, you know, Dr. Google is not a friend of the monoclonals. And they're scared to death when they read Google. I have to be informed. You and I have to be very informed about our field because so many things are being informed and misinformed from what patient sources are.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach. And of course, they're not mutually exclusive in that we often will have patients on symptomatic therapy as well as one of the disease-modifying therapies. And you and I both agree that lifestyle modification is something that we recommend and counsel patients about. Every patient about, in addition to whatever we might be doing pharmacologically. So the last issue is, how do you monitor, look for response or lack thereof with the disease-modifying therapies, and what do you recommend for the patients and families to look for?
So in their workflow, George, what we've done is we do the scheduled MRIs according to the label. we do the dot phrase before they start with the dot phrase for the CMS.gov. We have a nurse practitioner that is running our infusion clinic. So the one doing the checks for the making sure the prescriptions are on track, making sure the MRIs are on track, reviewing the MRIs, coordinating with infusion centers, although we're bringing that in-house now. So there's a lot of labor on the back end, as you know, a lot of approvals before they even start. And then after a year or so, I will check a PET scan. I know you're supposed to go the full 18 months, but I will tell you that patients don't want to wait, so I'll do a PET. And if they're cleared, either with either one, then I'll switch them to a maintenance with lecanemab or stop with donanemab.
What about clinical monitoring? What do you do clinically, and what do you recommend for the family to look for?
So I would check for ARIA, making sure they're having no complications, but most patients are doing fine, right? So they come in, and I would never do a MOCA more than every 6 months, but I do a month, you know, at 6 months and at 12 months, and monitor them that way. I ask very clearly, what do you think, to the patient and the family? Some patients are like, I've noticed nothing. Some patients tell me they're better. This is self-report. Maybe this is their own bias. Maybe it's a placebo effect, but some people have self-reported that they're better. And then, of course, I do MOCA and make sure there's safety issues. So a lot of it, post-starting infusion, there's just safety monitoring rather than efficacy monitoring, at least for the first year.
That sounds good. What about activities of daily living? How much emphasis do you put on that as far as a patient and family monitoring those?
So I see you do the Barthel, which is very impressive. And, you know, some people do FAQs. Some people do, I do the FAST. But I do ask about autonomy, independence, loss of autonomy, independence. And I track that over time using the FAST is what I tend to use.
That's very useful, too. So we're kind of run out of time. Any final takeaways, bottom line messages for our audience?
Yes, this is a transformative moment in the field. We're now taking Alzheimer's from a terminal disease, as you and I know it, or have known about it, to a chronic disease, the diabetes and HIV of our time, that we will continue to evolve that, but it means we need to be on the front end of the diagnostics with the biomarkers and on the front end of the therapeutics. The DMTs for amyloid are just the beginning of many, many drugs that could be coming available to us.
Thank you very much. That's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you, Marwan.
Thank you for including me, George. Good to see you.
Thank you, Dr. Groesbeck and Dr. Sabak, for highlighting the diagnosis, management, and treatment of MCI due to AD. Thank you to all of you for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in to the remaining episodes in this series as we continue our discussion on the diagnosis and treatment of MCI due to AD with other specialists who care for patients with Alzheimer's. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group, who, in support of improving patient care, is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. This activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And thank you to Lilly for providing an educational grant for this activity. Have a wonderful day.